Emerald Podcast Series. Research that makes a difference.
Hi, my name is Daniel Ridge, and I'm a commissioning editor at Emerald Publishing. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Ingrid Waldron about her new book, From the Enlightenment to Black Lives Matter, tracing the impacts of racial trauma in Black communities from the colonial era to the present. Dr. Waldron is a professor and Hope Chair in Peace and Health at McMaster University. She has dedicated her career to examining how anti-Black racism and discrimination impact health and mental health. In her most recent book, she offers a powerful examination of how historical legacies of racial trauma continue to shape the mental health experiences of Black communities today. In our conversation, we'll discuss the intersections of race and culture in psychiatry, the impact of colonial attitudes in regards to psychiatry, and how Black communities navigate mental health challenges amid systematic barriers. So, Ingrid, your work and advocacy on environmental justice, health, and racial equity have led to impactful initiatives, including Canada's first federal environmental racism law and the Sisterhood Initiative for Black Women's Mental Health in Nova Scotia. Could you share your background, how your background and growing up in a multicultural family in Montreal and your academic journey influenced your focus on these issues?
When I was a young child, I wanted to be either a child psychologist or a child psychiatrist. So I had an interest in health in general and mental health. I think the health maybe stemmed a bit maybe from my father. My father was a dentist. I had this vision of my father and I working in a dental clinic together, you know, and then I realized I didn't like biology or science or and I wasn't good at those subjects. So I realized that it wasn't for me. And then, you know, I did a degree in psychology at McGill University in Montreal, which is where I was born, because of that interest in psychology. But because of the way it was taught, I guess at McGill, you know, there was a focus on Freud and all of the kind of classic theorist. I wasn't engaged with the way it was being taught. And I realized that I liked my sociology courses more. And it was only when I decided to do a PhD in the sociology and equity studies and education department, did I realize that I saw the world more as a sociologist than anything else. I became very interested in racism and sexism and classism, and realized that I can actually bring together my interest in psychology with my interest in sociology and race and ethnicity, which is what I did with my doctoral thesis. I looked specifically at the impact of racism and other forms of discrimination on the mental health of Black women. The environmental work I did later, it came very much later. My plan was to first of all be a health professional, be a psychiatrist. And then I lost interest in that. I realized I didn't want to be a health practitioner. I was much more interested in data and doing research. I loved my experience in England. I did a master's degree in intercultural education at the Institute of Education at the University of London in England. And a lot of it was focused on school dropout rates of Black students and racism in the schools. And while I was in England, I was being introduced through the literature on Black feminist work for the very first time. I loved it. So a little way into my PhD, I met with my supervisor and I said, I think I'm going to change my thesis topic from the high dropout rates of Black students in high school to the impact of racism and discrimination on the mental health of Black women. I realized I found my passion.
So that naturally leads us to the book that you've just published with us, the From Enlightenment to Black Lives Matter. Can you tell us about this book and how that fits into your overall research? I mean, this one focuses really on the intersections of race and culture in psychiatry, and it's a complex story that you tell in this book. So maybe if you could introduce our readers to the book and what your purpose with the book was.
Yeah, I would say that some parts of the book came out of my PhD thesis. So in my PhD thesis, while I did look at the impact of discrimination on Black women in the present day, and I did original research, much of my thesis, my doctoral thesis, focused on psychiatric imperialism, colonialism.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, because that's an important concept that you bring up.
Yeah, I mean, it was all new to me. I was reading about mental health. It put me on to literature on psychiatry and kind of colonialism and psychiatry and the ways in which the Black body was viewed and perceived in the colonial era, and how psychiatry played a significant role in how the Black body was viewed. And I thought all of this was so fascinating. And I included much of it in my PhD thesis, and then also did some original research, as I said, speaking with Black women with mental health issues, and incorporated that into my thesis. So the book includes, you know, new recent research that I've done in Halifax when I was teaching at Dalhousie, and also in Hamilton, because I'm now teaching at McMaster. So it's recent work, original work. But also, I think it's important to look at the experiences of Black communities and mental illness within the context of colonialism and psychiatry, and not just psychiatry, but also other mental health professions that are influenced by psychiatry. I think it gives the book kind of a very interesting perspective. It brings the past forward to the present in many ways, because the ways in which Black people, Black women, Black men are diagnosed today is very much informed by kind of long-held perceptions of Black people during the colonial era that has endured up until today.
Right. Well, that brings us back to this concept of psychiatric imperialism. Can you maybe just expand on that a little bit and how that fits into your research?
Yeah, what I'm talking about when I examine psychiatric imperialism is it's about the dominance of psychiatry, not in just the Western world, but in also the non-Western world. So psychiatry obviously is medicine. It's an offshoot of medicine, and Western medicine particularly, and Western medicine holds power and dominance around the world, right? Even in Eastern countries, or even in African countries as well, many people who are doctors have been trained in Western society. You know, I did a research specifically looking at Black mental health professionals, many of them from Africa, who rarely adhere to Western approaches. They don't adhere to African-centered approaches. They adhere to Western approaches because they were educated in Africa through Western approaches, but they were also educated in the Western world, in the United States and Canada. So their belief systems are very much influenced by Western psychiatric modalities, interestingly enough, and many of them dismissed or denigrated African-centered ideologies or modalities. So that just speaks to the dominance of Western psychiatry and the power it holds, and the power it holds in terms of certainly diagnoses and assessments and how they treat bodies often that are non-Western bodies, Black individuals. I'm particularly interested in how that dominance has impacted and in many ways harmed Black folks, but also the dominance of Western psychiatry also in many ways subjugates alternative knowledges. You know, so looking at alternative knowledges, whether it's coming from Eastern society or African society, I talk a little bit in the book about how African centered ideologies or African centered knowledge pertaining specifically to health and mental health is often dismissed by Western society, but that's partly due to the dominance of psychiatry and Western modalities in medicine, because Western modalities are seen as scientific and African centered modalities are often seen as exotic, unscientific, and therefore harmful. So that was a really, for me, important aspect of the book to talk about that, because it provides the context within which to understand how powerful psychiatric diagnoses are, how they've informed psychiatric diagnoses specifically for Black men and Black women in kind of very different ways versus white men and white women, you know, the patterns of diagnosing, for example, Black men, what we see is an overdiagnosis or misdiagnosis of schizophrenia. And for Black women, we often see an underdiagnosis of affective disorders like depression and bipolar, but we see maybe sometimes an overdiagnosis of those illnesses in white women. And what I say in the book is that, you know, perceptions about the Black body often collide with perceptions of mental illness. So in certainly Western societies, all societies, we often see schizophrenia as extremely pathological and dangerous. That's how it's portrayed. That's how it's portrayed in our culture, in popular culture. I remember seeing One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest when I was a young child. And movies like that and other movies have often depicted people with schizophrenia as incredibly pathological, crazy, and dangerous to be feared. And in our society, of course, Black men are seen in the same way. Black men are more than any other group are seen as dangerous, pathological, and to be feared. So what I argue in the book is that perceptions of Blackness often collide with perceptions of specific mental illnesses and play a role in diagnosing Black peoples and other people.
Well, another big element of your book is a focus on intergenerational racial trauma, and you do discuss epigenetics. Can you talk a little bit about intergenerational racial trauma and what that looks like and what that really means?
Yeah, I mean, I do. In many ways, I see similarities between intergenerational trauma, particularly in Black communities, and epigenetics. I first learned about epigenetics probably 10 years ago, looking at YouTube. There was a doctor called Dr. Lipton. Dr. Bruce Lipton was or is a cell biologist who was the traditional cell biologist. And then I think he did a study and he coined the term epigenetics because he noticed that there are changes to the cell membrane when negative things happen, negative external, where those cell membranes are in an external environment that's very negative. Then he noticed that the cell membrane changes in a negative way. And intergenerational trauma is very similar. What intergenerational trauma tends to argue is that our focus, our obsession with seeing genetics and biology as playing the main role in health, physical health, and in mental illness is maybe a bit dated. I think increasingly we are understanding that external social environments have the biggest role to play in health and mental health. So for example, in my book, I talk a lot about the structural determinants of health, which is basically epigenetics, and how issues such as poor housing and poverty and low socioeconomic status and environmental racism, environmental toxins, and poor public infrastructure and food insecurity, those external structural determinants of health have much more of a bearing on ill health, physical health, and mental health than genetics and biology. So kind of like the days when we used to say, oh, my mother had cancer, I guess I'm going to get cancer. That's no longer true. It doesn't mean that, you know, having something hereditary in your family doesn't play a role, but it plays a smaller role than we used to think. So I take up this issue of structural determinants of health, how that impacts the mental health of Black communities, because Black communities fare worse in our social structures than many other communities.
That's really, really fascinating. And it makes me think of a lot of different examples. But, you know, one of the things that you talk about in chapter 3, you look at anti-Black racism as a public health crisis.
Yes.
And specifically through the lens of Black Lives Matter.
Yes.
The Black Lives Matter movement. Could you expand on how racism and various social structures impacts mental health in Black communities?
Well, if we do agree that epigenetics is real, and I think it is, and I think there's enough evidence out there to indicate that it is, then it makes sense then that your health and well-being, including your mental health, if you believe that health, as I do, is holistic, then what impacts your physical health will impact your mental health, and what impacts your mental health will impact your physical health. I think many of us can think about instances where we're feeling low, we're feeling a bit blue, we're feeling depressed, and sometimes we feel it in our body and vice versa. So because Black people tend to fare worse in our various social structures, that is going to impact on their well-being. So these social structures, as I mentioned in my book, include education, employment, labor, the immigration system, public infrastructure, one's access to healthcare, whether or not you're underutilizing healthcare or not, and certainly the criminal justice system and anti-Black policing. So there's what I'm arguing is there is anti-Black racism in every one of our social structures, primarily because the people who get to make policy within those social structures don't look like me. They're often not coming from marginalized communities, and particularly Black people. The ones who hold power to make those decisions and policies within our social structures are typically white. And many of those policies and decisions that they make are harmful to Black and other communities on the ground. And if you believe that one's well-being, and if you, once again, if you believe in holistic understandings of health, and that one's well-being, one's social, economic, and political well-being plays a role in one's health and mental health, then you know that's certainly an example of the structural determinants of health and what the structural determinants of health argues, that those structures and policies and decisions within those structures do have an impact on one's health and mental health. So anti-Blackness, I argue in the book, is a important mental health issue, is a public health crisis. Difficult for people to understand that because it's only, at least in Canada, only recently that Canada has acknowledged racism as a structural determinant of health. I think that was 2018. It was the Canadian Public Health Association wrote a draft paper. And not that I needed them to tell me this because I've been teaching, right? But they wrote this draft paper saying, okay.
Well, you open your book by discussing that. I mean, that's one of the first things you talk about. And so that is very, very significant.
Yeah. And that is taking Canada a long time to acknowledge that. And that's an important, obviously, association or body. But many of us already knew that. But they acknowledged that in that draft paper that racism is a structural determinant of health. And that's really, really important. It's key that they did that because it was dismissed in the past. And that's something I've always taught, but it gives legitimacy, I think, to this notion that racism is a real, authentic health and mental health issue.
Yeah. Well, you also focus on how Black communities perceive mental illness and the influence of factors like spirituality and the family. So what are some of the unique cultural approaches that Black communities use to address mental health?
The approaches that they use to address mental health will reflect their belief systems around mental health. I started looking at this actually during my PhD. I discovered a lot of things I didn't realize, although my parents are from the Caribbean. So I got a sense of some of them being certainly the case with Caribbean individuals. And of course, Caribbean people are descendants of Africa, and it's similar in Africa as well. A lot of Black people, Black communities tend to think that if you have a mental illness, you should just pray it away. Stop being weak is what many people think. Pull up your bootstraps, get with it, get on it, stop being weak. And if you're suffering from something, just pray it away. If you believe in God, and you know, for many Black people, you should believe in God, then just pray it away. The harder you pray, it's going to go away. And if that's what you believe, then yeah, the solution for some people is to pray and also to speak to God and to attend church or a faith institution, a spiritual institution. There are also some people who believe in faith healers. Faith healers often work underground. And maybe there's a bit of a taboo in some African and Caribbean societies about faith healers, but faith healers are people who will use spirituality and specific ointments, even ointments in bath, you know, having a wash in a bathtub. I know a friend who did this, and they have special ointments, and it's very spiritual, and there's a belief that that will take the evil away, because there's a belief in many Black communities that if you are suffering from a mental illness, it's because you are being punished by evil spirits. you have done something malevolent in your community. Maybe you've cheated on your husband or something like that, and now you are being punished. So evil spirits are within you, and those evil spirits have to be gotten rid of. I remember when I was doing my PhD, I read an article about a particular country in Africa. I forgot what it was called, but they were literally beating the evil out of a person who had mental illness and beating with like a set of shrubs, I guess, beating it out of the person. So there's those very kind of traditional, maybe for some people, astonishing beliefs about how mental illness should be treated. If you are somebody with an idea that I would call it a mixed approach. So there are people who believe in Western medicine, they partake in Western medicine, but they also see the kind of traditional African or Caribbean ways of treating illness as maybe more foolproof. So they have that to kind of pull out of their back pocket if the Western medicine doesn't work. So I've seen a lot of people like that who use a mixed methods approach, meaning they are going to visit maybe the GP or the psychiatrist, but they also are going to be visiting the faith healer. So they believe in both approaches. And that often has to do with, you know, sometimes education or their exposure to Western medicine, whether or not they're living in a Western society or not, a society like Canada or the UK, because they're going to be influenced by the general belief of the population, of course. And then you have people who are, you know, when I did my work on Black women's mental illness, I was kind of surprised at the alternative methods they were using. Things that I've never heard of, like sound baths. I don't know what that is, really. Meditation, mindfulness healing, certainly spirituality. Some people said, well, I smoke weed. Others said, I dance. It was just a wide mixture, which I don't know. It surprised me. I got a sense that Black women were interested, certainly, in alternative approaches from doing my PhD way back in 2002. But the extent to which some of these women talked about the fact that they would kind of dip into anything, they're willing to try anything, I think that's actually more common now amongst Black people.
How do we, I mean, you talked about the mixed methods, but I think, you know, it's interesting how these two overlap, the psychiatric imperialism, this Western way of psychiatry that we just have taken for granted because it's sort of the transparent, you know, all psychiatry in general. And then you have Black communities sort of responding to it in different ways. And I guess that would be the cultural context of those different communities as well, whether that's in Canada or the Caribbean, you know, that's going to have a different sort of, I'm just wondering about trying to reconcile the two or to bring them together, or what is the role of maybe a therapist in these spaces?
Yeah, well, I found also with the recent studies I've done on Black youth in Hamilton, and Black youth in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and of course, Black women in Nova Scotia, that they are actually seeking therapy more and more. This was something that Black people typically didn't do. The idea is we're too strong for that. Only white people do that. That's a white people thing, is something I heard in recent conversations I've had when I was doing research with Black youth. That's for white people. Family members would say, why are you doing that? That's for white people. But I would say more and more, I'm finding that Black women are seeing therapists, and maybe therapists more than psychiatrists. There's still some skepticism about psychiatry, and of course, they're able to prescribe drugs, and Black people also have this kind of resistance to medication. So that's happening more and more. I think Black people are being influenced by Western society more and more, seeing therapists, but I also feel like there's a healthy skepticism that they have, and always knowing that they can go back to those traditional approaches, those traditional therapies that come from their Caribbean or African heritage.
Well, one of the issues that you address, trying to maybe reconcile this a bit, is you know, how you critique the concept of cultural competency and advocate for structural competency in mental health.
Yes.
Maybe it'd be helpful if you talk a little bit about the difference between the two and what you mean by advocating for structural competency.
I learned a lot about structural competency from one of my favorite authors, professors, psychiatrist, Dr. Jonathan Metzl, who teaches at Vanderbilt University. I think I read an article that he talked, where he talks about structural competency, maybe back in 2016, and it just opened my eyes. I thought, wow, I love this. This makes sense. It's very upstream, but it makes so much sense. And I didn't want to argue to people that I was abandoning cultural competency, because I remember when I said to myself, I want people to know about this. I want to kind of introduce it in Halifax, where I was living at the time. And I said, the presentations I'm going to do from now on will be talking about the need to not just focus on cultural competency, but also move a little bit beyond that, but not dismiss cultural competency. And I started to do that, and people started to kind of come to understand structural competency. So I don't want to dismiss or throw out cultural competency, because basically cultural competency says you need to be empathic and sensitive and culturally aware. You know, for people who are sitting down with you, if you're a doctor or a therapist, recognizing that people are coming from different parts of the world with different cultures, different cultural orientations and worldviews, that has to be respected. Because one of the things that doctors and psychiatrists must do is to develop rapport and trust with clients. That's big. Like any health professional I know says, yeah, we have the technical skills, but you know what, Ingrid, what's most important is the fact that we need to develop good relationships and rapport with our clients. So understanding, and you can't understand every culture in the world, but understanding as much as you can different cultural orientations and worldviews and ways of knowing is really important. But I always say that that's not going to address somebody's mental health issues. People, and we have to go, in order to argue that, you have to go back to structural determinants of health. If we are arguing that for the most part, people are dealing with mental health issues as a result of poverty and income insecurity and food insecurity and the stressors in their lives, that means it's important for doctors to try to address those issues. And unfortunately, being patient and culturally aware isn't going to help somebody with their income insecurity and their housing issues. So while doctors and other health professionals might say, that's not my job, it is their job, which is what Jonathan Metzl argues. And I would argue that if the structural issues like poverty and income insecurity play the largest role in the mental health issues of somebody who's sitting in front of you, then the onus is on you as a psychiatrist to connect that person to social structures that can help them. And that is what structural competency is about. It's about how competent are you as a health professional to understand the social structures in that person's environment that can help that person. So that means, and it's very upstream approach. It means if that person is dealing with food security, maybe you're connecting them to a food bank. If that person is dealing with legal issues, maybe you connect them to a legal aid clinic. If they're dealing with external or environmental justice issues, environmental pollution, etc., there are also ways to do that in terms of getting on boards and committees and advocating for communities that are dealing with environmental racism and other environmental injustices. So it says that the onus is on the health professional to make those connections. We're not asking health professionals to do all the work, but to also to surround themselves with teams of people, social workers, nutritionists, etc. I mean, we see that in many hospitals, but also people outside the hospital system. Right. So doctors are very good with surrounding themselves with people within the hospital to help patients, but not as good at identifying those outside institutions and social structures that they can bring in and connect to clients. So that is what structural determinants of health is. It says that instead of trying to pursue pathologies, I guess, within the body of individuals, particularly Black individuals, you should be pursuing the pathologies within our social structures, because our social structures are problematic. Our social structures are embedded with all these inequities. They're pathological. So instead of trying to find those pathologies or problems within the person, try to rectify the problems and inequities within our social structures.
Yeah, wow. There's a lot there. So that gets me thinking about what are some real actions. And so what do you think are some real actions that can make a real difference in addressing racial trauma and supporting mental health in Black communities?
For me, much of this is rooted in education. So what is being taught in medical schools? What is being taught in the health professions? I spent some time in the School of Nursing. I'm not a nurse, but it was a really great experience because they did want somebody like me, a sociologist, to come in and teach this stuff. Everything I'm telling you right now, that's what they wanted. And it was great for me to be using my sociological background to kind of get nursing students out of their nursing box to see things in different ways. So I would say that maybe before I came along, issues like the social and structural determinants of health and structural competency were not being taught. So the root of all of this is education. We need to train and educate future health professionals around this work so it doesn't seem foreign to them. When I came in, it seemed foreign. There were a lot of questions from students. Why was Ingrid hired? They didn't understand why I was there. They didn't understand why what I was teaching had anything to do with nursing. Of course, it has everything to do with nursing, but they didn't get it. So I seemed like a bit of an anomaly, and they were questioning what I was doing there, which was really interesting. So we need to educate this and normalize it, what I was teaching and what other people are teaching now. I'm very optimistic because I'm seeing it now. At that time, I was teaching a structural determinants of health course in nursing, probably one of the few courses in Canada, but I'm seeing it being taught now at the University of Toronto and other universities. And I hear from people saying to me, oh, yeah, I was taught that in my course. Like they're even in other courses that have nothing to do with structural determinants of health, in their health courses, they're learning about the structural determinants of health, diversity, and cultural competence. So I am very hopeful. And more, for example, Black individuals are entering PhD programs and medical schools and health professions. So that also helps because they're bringing their personal experiences. Doesn't mean that they, just because they're Black, they know about the structural determinants of health and that they don't need to be also educated, but they're bringing personal experiences. The other thing I think is research needs to change, and that's only going to change once again if we get more faculty who are Black and racialized in various ways. So we need more people to collect original data in Black communities that can share their experiences around mental health and their access and struggles and barriers that they face accessing mental health services. We need grant competitions that are more inclusive of Black researchers. So, we've got the academic granting bodies like SHRC and CIHR in Canada. And only recently I'm seeing a change. I'm very happy to see that change, that there was a competition a few months ago on the structural determinants of health, asking people to put in proposals, grant proposal. We've never seen that before. So I'm very hopeful. So I think research has to change. I think granting bodies need to prioritize Black researchers and Black research. I think there's a lot to say for community-based initiatives. I don't want that to let the mental health system off the hook. But I think in community, Black communities are also, because they don't want to wait around for the mental health system to get its act together, Black communities are also starting up very interesting mental health initiatives on their own because they're not satisfied with what they're seeing in the mental health system. Once again, I think we have to be careful with that because the onus is on the mental health system to make a change. And if they think that Black communities are just going to solve everything, which they're not going to be able to do, they don't have the money to do that, then they're going to feel that they don't have any responsibility to make the changes. I also think mental health policy is key. Policy is everything. I have students in my classrooms who are often frustrated, because I tell them all the bad stuff about what's going on. And they say, Professor Waldron, this doesn't seem to ever be changing. How is it going to change? You tell us all this stuff and it's not changing. I say, you know when it's going to change? When the policymakers look like me, because they're the ones with the power and they're the ones with the decision-making power. So until they start looking like me and other non-white individuals, yes, things will be very slow to change because policymakers are navigating their worlds in a particular way based on their race, based on their middle classness, based on their education. And it's often very difficult for them to see and understand the experiences of people who are not white. So we need more racialized people to get into mental health policy and health policy more broadly.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. For more information about my guest and her new book, please find us online by searching Emerald Publishing Podcast Series. I'd like to thank Professor Ingrid Waldron for speaking with me today and the studio This Is Distorted.